Blog Talk Radio.
There's a direct relationship between having the businesses and being in prison. Go find an Asian, see how many Asians you can find in American prisons. They ain't gonna be in there. But 51% of your prison will be black because blacks don't have any businesses and industries. There's a direct link. Blacks won't practice group economics. Blacks won't practice group politics. If you don't practice, you're setting yourself up. I told that five-story building, you're setting yourself to get wiped out. Understand the nature of race, which is economics. If you build the first floor, it's economic. Build your businesses and your industries. Control business and industry, and put that pulls in your money, and hold that money, and practice group economics with it. Arab and Asian money bounces 12 to 13 times for a lead. Jewish money bounces 18 times. Black folks got to learn how to practice group economics. Black Americans spend every penny they get outside their own community. Then you take the money and the wealth that you get from that first floor and go to the second floor. The second floor is politics. You then take that money on the first floor and you control your politics. Black folk must quit allowing people to tell them to go out and vote. Vote for what? Nobody's going to do anything for black folk in politics. Politics is controlled by money. Major corporations, who got the money? That's what controls politics. If you have no money, you have no say-so, you have no benefits coming. So you take your money and you control and you take your money on the first floor, you buy every politician on the second floor. And any politician you can't buy, you rent or lease them to get what you need. Then once you get the second floor under control with your politician, with your money, then you go to the third floor. The third floor then is the police department and the court system. You take your money from the first floor and your politics on the second floor and you control the court system and the police department. Then the fourth floor, then is media. You then take the money that you generate off the first floor from business and industries and you go after radio stations, TV stations, newspapers, and cable systems so that you can now inform and communicate with your own people. Right now, black folk own and control less than 35 thousandths of 1% of the media in the United States. Out of 12,000 radio stations, black folk own about 75 or 80. That's all. You own no cable systems. You don't have a daily newspaper. You have nothing of importance. You got about one black TV station. So you can't communicate with your people. You can't inform your people. You can't do anything. You can have Rush Limbaugh and all the rest of the guys talking about racism all day long and bad-mouthing you. And O'Reilly, they can call black folk all kind of names all day long. What are you going to do? You can't respond. You can't even communicate with your own people because you don't have an economic base. 51% of all the prisons in the United States are black people. You only make up 12% of the population. That's no accident. It's because you don't control the economics and the politics. And they're going to go after the weakest people they can get their hands on to incarcerate. That's the black folk. And what are you going to do in response to them when they over-incarcerate you? You're going to go out and have a march, a demonstration. We're going to march. March, boy, who cares? Marching has never changed anything.
Adam Clayton Powell, for the first time, was defeated. Charles Rangel won in a very close election. Within a few years, Adam Clayton Powell would contract cancer and die.
If we must die, let us not die like hogs, penned in some inglorious spot. What use is an extra year or two to the man who kills the time that God has given him?
Much of the story of Adam Clayton Powell is on display here in this anteroom of the Abyssinia Baptist Church. But there are many parts of the Adam Powell story that you cannot see hanging up on the walls, mainly the ironies in his life. Isn't it ironic that Adam Powell was such a loud voice that few people would listen to? Perhaps if his loud voice had been heeded on the question of police corruption, there may not have been a Knapp Commission. If his loud voice about government corruption had been heeded, there may not have been a Watergate. If his loud voice against hypocrisy on Capitol Hill had been heeded, perhaps Wayne Hayes and Tom Dodd and Earl Butz and Carl Albert and countless others might have not have been caught in such embarrassing situations. Adam Clayton Powell represents still another chapter in a long story of black militant fighters against oppression and injustice here in America. He wasn't perfect. He had his faults, but don't we all? The point is, he was a fighter. If he did play, He worked harder than he played. Most of all, he was a fighter.
As far as I know here, you're in trouble. Where it says about 30% are unemployed. That's why I'm working hard to get this surplus food here. Some of you say to me, well, I'm not like you. I'm not a congressman. I haven't got education. I haven't got work. But you're a human being. And you know what you've got? You've got in your hand the power to use your vote and to use even those few cents you get from welfare to spend them only where you want to spend them. A young slave boy stood one day before the greatest ruler of his day. And God said to Moses, what's in your hand? And Moses said, Lord, only I've got a stick, that's all. He said, well, let me use what's in your hand. And God used that slave boy with a stick in his hand to divide the Red Seas, march through a wilderness, bring water out of rocks, manna from heaven, and bring his people to freedom land. What's in your hand? What's in your hand? George Washington Carver, who was so frail that he was traded for a broken-down horse as a slave boy. And George Washington Carver, sitting in the science laboratory at Tuskegee, told me, he said, Dr. Powell, he said, I just go out on the field each morning at 5 o'clock, and I let God guide me. And I bring back these little things and work them over my laboratory, and that man did more to revolutionize the agricultural science of peanuts and of cotton and sweet potato than any other human being in the field of agricultural science. What's in your hand? Just let God use you, that's all. What's in your hand? I've got a string in my hand, that's all, and I'm flying a kite. And way up in the heavens, lightning strikes it, and I, Benjamin Franklin, discover for the first time the possibilities of electricity with a string in my hand. What's in your hand? Little hunchback sitting in a Roman jail. I haven't got anything in my hand but an old quill pen, but God says, write what I tell you to write. Paul wrote, I have run my race with patience. I have finished my course. I have kept the faith. Henceforth has laid up in me. What's in your hand, little boy? All I've got is a slingshot. And the enemies of my people are great and big and more numerous than we are. Well, little David, go down to the brook and pick out a few stones and come on back and close your eyes if you want to and pull back that slingshot and let it go. And David killed the biggest enemy, the leader of the giants, against his people, and his people became free, just letting God guide a stone in his hand. And a few years passed, and David is a king. And God says, what's in your hand? He said, I've got a harp in my hand. He said, well, David, play on your harp. And he played, the Lord is my shepherd. I shall not want. Maketh me to lie down in green pastures. Leadeth me beside still waters. Yea, though I walk through the valley in the shadow of death, I'll fear no evil. What's in your hand? What's in your hand? Man hanging on a cross? I've got two nails in my hand. Father, I stretch my hand to thee. No other help I know. If thou withdraw thyself from me, whither shall I go? And that man, with two nails in his hand, spit history in hair, B.C. and A.D. And what's in your hand tonight, people of Cambridge? You've got God in your hand, and he'll let you win, because he's on your side and one with God, always in the majority. So walk with him, and talk with him, and work with him, and stick together, and fight together. And with God's hand in your hand, the victory will be accomplished here sooner than you dreamed, sooner than you hoped, sooner than you prayed for, sooner than you imagined. Good night, and God bless you.
Now learn this from Joel Osteen. That's my man. He be texting me. That's my man. This God done put some people around me, show me some stuff. He was telling this story. He said, This man that went to heaven, he was walking with Peter down this aisleway, and it was going down this corridor, had a lot of doors on it, and said all these doors had names on it. And he said, Peter, let me ask you something. What's all these doors, these names on? He said, don't worry about it, just go ahead. So he kept walking. He messed around, he saw one of them doors and had his name on it. He said, whoa. He said, hey, Peter, this here ain't got my name on it. Something I need to know? He said, man, don't worry about that. You here now. Just go on in there and talk to him. See what he's here. He said, nah, I won't know what's in the door. He said, you sure you won't see what's in the door? He said, yeah. So he opened up the door. It was a warehouse. It had number shelves on it. And then the shelves had nothing but packages. And all the packages had his name on them. And he said, what is all these boxes? He said, that's all of the blessings, all of the things God wanted to ship to you. But number one, you didn't ask him for it. Then number two, you didn't believe you would have it. Then you doubted him. And then you felt like you wasn't worthy. And so now all these boxes is up here. Now the man standing there wishing he had never even been in the room. And I started thinking. I got some dudes that work for me. And I said, I want you to do this graph for me. And that's what I'm finna show you now. See, what you happen is, when God sends your package, he only sends it to one street. That's Faith Street. You got to stay in faith. You can't move off of Faith Street. You can't get on Doubted Drive. You can't be over there and start doubting it, because your package going to go right on by. You can't lose your faith and get on Not Meant to Be Way, because your package is going to keep going right on by. Because the package just go to Faith Street. You can get your little feelings hurt, I ain't worthy. Guess what? Your package going to keep going right on by. You have not because you ask not. Then you sit up here and start feeling sorry for yourself. You go on Pity Way, your package keep going right on by. If you stay right on Faith Street, don't ever come off, because the blessing is coming. If you wait on it, here it comes. It may not come when you want it, but it on time. But if you get up and you move off of Faith Street, your box gonna get sent back to sender. And now you're gonna have a warehouse with a bunch of boxes with your name on it that you didn't never get. And I don't know about you, but I want everything he got for me. If he got something for me, I need all of mine. Because I don't know about you, but God lay you out, man. God will give you stuff. Man, he done took me places. I ain't never thought I was going to go. I done seen parts of the world I never even thought I could go to. He done gave me stuff. He done put people in my life. God will do it for you, man. But you just got to stay, man. Use these principles of success. Understand, God is just that way. He'll lay you out. Because if he can lay me out, see, if he fix me and change me and get me over here trying to do better, I ain't perfect. I'm just trying to do better. I still say some stuff I ain't supposed to say. You understand? I ain't got it all together yet. I just got in the gate. I'm a new kind of Christian. But ain't no lock on my gate either. So if you see, once you check me, I'm probably going to check you back. But I'm getting better at that. I don't know how to love my enemies yet. I'm getting better at it, though. But it's a process. And the more times we can make people understand that it's a process, the more people can come in. And y'all people that have been good to me, that have been praying for me. I mean, man, my mama, if she could see me now, I just wish my mama could see me. Because she's been praying for this hill all her life. Watch my son. Well, he done watched me, mama. And I'm cool now. And my philosophy is very simple. I was who I was, but I am who I am. And I'm cool with both them people. Because who I was wasn't that bad cap. I made some mistakes, but I've been changed a little bit. And it's still a process. And the more people that you invite into the process, the better this is. Because ain't nobody perfect no how. So I really appreciate y'all, man, hearing me and listening to me. I'm going to ask Kirk Franklin if he will come.
Well, hey, folks, and welcome to Solar Cabin Channel. I've got a neat little project for you. I call the Multi-Shack. This is one of my homeless housing solutions designs. And some of you probably don't know this, but I was homeless twice in my life. The first time was when I was trying to get into college, and I had lost my job and was waiting for my college funding to come in. And so I had to live in my truck. I lived in the cab of my truck for almost 2 months while I waited for my college funding to come in. And then again later in life when I got divorced and didn't have a job and was trying to get off grid, I lived for almost 2 years in a camp trailer. And, you know, there's a lot of people that, homeless people that have their pride. They want to maintain their independence. They don't want to live on welfare. They don't want to be caught up in the system. And, you know, all they need is a simple shelter, you know, someplace to get out of the cold, to get out of the wind, to get out of the rain, while they get back on their feet. And so I know there's a lot of organizations out there that are helping the homeless, churches, nonprofits, and things like that. So I came up with this small structure design, which I call the multi-shack, because it has actually multi-uses to it. And it can be built very affordably. You can build this entire shack for under $200. And it is built on wheels. It can be put on either a 4x6 trailer, or you can build it on casters. Casters are a lot less expensive, but it still allows you to move this unit around. So you could store, you know, a bunch of these on a church parking lot, and then just when you need them, you can move them out to wherever you want the person to be using them. Casters are 4-inch casters. Each caster will hold up to 240 pounds, so they'll more than handle the weight for this structure here. Now, this structure is 6'5" from the peak to the bottom, 6'5", so and even a tall person can stand upright inside this structure. The door is 1'6" wide and about 5'3" to the peak up there in the door, and the structure is 4 foot wide approximately and about 6 foot long, by 4 foot wide, 6'5" to the peak. And this is constructed very inexpensively from 2x4 framing, which I'll show you, and uses, I would use 7/16 OSB or plywood. Either one would work for the siding on this. Now, a couple of the features here. I show this with dorm windows. The dorm windows are actually optional. You don't have to put dorm windows. You can just go with a flat roof surface if you want here. I show this with wood shingles, or you could use just plain old tar paper and roofing shingles. Any type of roofing shingles would work on this. Show it with a little flower box there just for effect. And on the backs and the front, I show this with these round windows, like boat-style windows, or you could put square windows. Either one works. I just like the effect of the round windows, the look of those in there. This does have an access panel on the back. Down here is an access panel. We'll just open this up so I can show you. Open up, take this one off. There we go. Now you can see inside the access panel. Underneath the seat and bed is storage, lots of storage underneath here for a propane tank, one of those Port-a-Loo porta-potties, an ice chest over there you can see. Okay, so there's good storage. This is about 18 inches high inside here and about 4 feet wide inside. So the structure, I'll show this with the door open. Let me just hide this door here. With the door open, you can see I've got this set up. Right now I've got it set up for seating. During the day, this would be used for seating purposes, okay? And I'm going to pull the side roof off here so I can show you inside. But this has a very nice space for a person that maybe is going to school or working, or just the table can be used for eating or whatever. So you've got approximately 6 feet of space on the inside here by 4 feet wide. And this table is actually part of the bed platform, which I'll show you. You just pull the 2x4 out, put it in one of these slots. It's in this 2x4 here. There's another one on the other side. You just drop the 2x4 into the slot, and then you take your bed panel and put it up on top of that, and then that becomes a table. Here you've got 2 foot by 4 foot cushions. There's three of these cushions that become your bed, or you can use a roll-up mattress pad underneath this that becomes your bed. But during the daytime, it becomes seating. It becomes a little mini couch in here, 4 foot wide. And now you've got a space for a student to do their studies, their work, or for having your meal, or if you're working on a hobby or a craft or something like that, you've got this nice little space. When you need to get out the door, you just lift the table up, put it back, put the 2x4 back in the bottom slots, put the table down, and, you know, then you turn it into a bed. And I'm going to show you what it looks like as a bed, too. So, good headroom in this. I really like that it's got a very good space. This is an average person, 5'8" tall. You can see you've got lots of headroom here. You've got these nice dormer windows, which would give you lots of light. Lots of light, and also gives you a little bit more headroom up in this area right in here. A 6-foot person could stand up in the middle of this quite comfortably. Two people could actually share, sit side by side on this couch, or you can put in another, you could pull your ice chest cooler out, or someone could put a foldable chair on the other side here. So you could actually have two people sitting side by side or crossways next to each other here. So lots of space in this little place. So let me show you what the framing looks like on this first. And I'll just have to zoom in on this. Now this is all done with 2x4 construction to keep it inexpensive and easy to build. And then I would sheathe it with either 7/16 inch OSB or plywood. Either one would work. Now it's got a floor frame, as you can see, made of 2x4s down here. Simple 2x4 frame, floor frame construction, and then your casters attached to the corners, not exactly in the corners, but they attach to the floor framing, and the casters have locks on them, so once you move this in place, you can just click on the locks and lock it in place so it won't be rolled around while the person is inside it. Now, this is the bed platform, and it has, this back platform is This back platform is 2'6" wide, and it is permanently connected. These are 1'9" wide platforms that can be raised up. And as you can see, these 2x4s right here, you put the 2x4 up in these other slots, and then you put these panels up on top, and they become either a table or a workspace. This one can go up here. This one can go on the end. It can go over the middle. So I gave you lots of options for the ways that you can organize this into workspace or living space as you need to use it. Very simple construction. Takes about 20 2x4s to build this. That's about it. And you're looking at about under $200 for all the material costs. And you could build one of these in a day. Seriously, you could build the complete unit in about a day. And now I'm going to show you on the inside how this can be used as a bed and also as a small business. So I'm just going to click off this. Okay, now I show this with the bed down, the door open so you can kind of get a peek inside here. Now, this is an uninsulated structure. You really don't need insulation in a small structure like this because the human body puts off about as much heat as a 90-watt light bulb. So in a small structure like this, your own body heat will actually heat it up. And for sleeping, you can either do these pads like this as mattress pads, or you can just get a sleeping bag pad or even an air cushion pad to go underneath it. A sleeping bag pad would work fine because you can roll it up and use it as your seating. And a good heavy-duty sleeping bag would be all you would need in order to sleep very comfortably in here. As long as you don't have the wind blowing on you or the rain drenching you or snow piling up on you, you'll sleep very comfortably in a small structure like this. Your own body heat will heat it up. You could add a heater to these, but it really isn't necessary in these small structures. So I'm going to pull off the side roof, and I'm going to show you how much space this has inside it for a bed. It actually has a very nice bed that will sleep either one or two people. Pull this off here. Just hide this. Now, this has a 4 foot wide by 6 foot long bed. So even an average person can sleep in here. Even a tall person, fairly tall person, could sleep in here comfortably without being cramped. And it's 4 foot wide, so that's a very wide bed that will actually sleep two people. Two people could sleep in this space, all right? And it's 6 foot wide, and it's 4 foot wide and 6 foot long. This person I show in here is about 5'8" tall, which is average height for most people. And here you can see the slots I was talking about. These platforms which I'll show you. I'll take the bed off now. These two platforms are removable with 2x4s underneath them. You just take the 2x4, you put it in the slots that go across here, and then put these platforms up on top to make your table. And you can actually do a table on either end or one in the middle for a desk and table. Now, the ones on the ends I'll show you are used if you want to run a small business out of here, or if you want to organize this in a different way so that if you're cooking, you could put one of these tables on this end or on this end, and you could set up your cooking supplies and you can take care of yourself. You can cook a meal inside this little place right here. So 4 foot wide, 6 foot long bed, and then very adaptable with these platforms of 2x4s. You can just put them up and you can reorganize this any way you want during the daytime for whatever function that you're going to be using. Again, it has storage space underneath the bed and seating. You've got that nice access panel for you got storage underneath there. And I really like the space in here. This would be enough adequate space if in an emergency, let's say that a city has a disaster, a fire like they just had in Canada wipes out all these homes, or you have a tornado tear through a place, or you have flooding or something like that, which we've all seen in the news, happens all the time, and suddenly churches are overrun with people that don't have housing. You know, if you had a bunch of these sitting around that would sleep at least two people, you could pull these out in a small area, you could set these up, and people would at least have shelter for, survival until they can get into houses or shelter, bigger shelters or something like that. So that's another use for this type of structure here. So now I'm going to put the bed back on just to show you. And again, you can see this has really nice dormer windows. So you got really good light in this. And it's got an excellent sleeping space. It would be better for one person, but it would be adequate for two people. Okay? And, if you got little teeny kids with you, you could put, one adult and a couple of kids in there, too. You know, there's enough space in there to sleep comfortably, and you've got lots and lots of headroom. You're not going to bump your head or anything while you're sleeping. Doorway, 1 foot 6 inches wide, 5 foot 3 inches to the top up here. So lots and lots of good space in this. Now I'm going to show you how this can also be modified to be used as a small business. Okay, one thing I know about people that are homeless is they're also very creative, and a lot of them actually run little businesses in order to support themselves. A lot of them do recycling. They recycle cans and bottles and other stuff like that, or they pick up small appliances and stuff that they may find on the streets, or books or pictures or whatever, and they resell them, and that's how they support themselves. A lot of them are also very crafty people. They may make jewelry, or they may make wood crafts or something like that, or they may be artists. And so they have a way to support themselves. And so I think we ought to encourage that, because that helps them to develop sustainability. Not everybody is equipped to work in the regular workforce. Some people just aren't. But they're very industrious and can support themselves with a small business. And so I thought, well, this shack could also be used for setting up a small business. So what I did is I made this so that the window here can be hinged up, and I'll show this. The window on one of the dormers, or both, can be hinged up out of the way. And then you've got room here to put a sales counter or little platform here where this person is 5 foot 8 inches tall. A person can stand in this window and they can operate a small business. They can talk to customers, they can take money, whatever, working right out of this small shack. Now, this doesn't necessarily have to be for homeless people. If you wanted to run a hot dog or hamburger stand, or sell your crafts or your books, or whatever you want to do with this, maybe it's a ticket stand, I don't know. This little shack could be very useful for a lot of different purposes. That's why I call it a multi-shack, is because it can be used for many different purposes. But this would be great for a homeless person that has a craft that they make or recycle products or whatever. They want to sell them. They just hinge up the window and they set themselves up a little business here to take care of customers. Now, this also shows inside how those tables can be reorganized. Here you can see I've lifted up the bed platform to put a table on this end, another table on this end, and you can use this for cooking in here. You can see I've got a little two-burner propane stove that you can set up on one of the tables up there so you can do your cooking. You can work on your crafts. This table just lifts off. The 2x4 lifts off if you need to get access to the door. Lots of good headroom, okay? Workspace in there. This can be modified many different ways for many different people of however you want to use it. So a very functional space in there. All right, so that is the multi-shack, all right? And let me just then hide this so you can get a better view of it. Again, can be built very inexpensively, around under $200 on casters, more expensive if you put it on a trailer. And I'm going to provide these plans for free because this is a project that I designed specifically for churches and nonprofit organizations to build shelters. And at present in the U.S., we have about 1.6 million homeless people that just need a simple shelter to live in. Or we have, that's about one out of 200 people. And that's just in the U.S. There's a lot of people in other countries that are in even worse shape. And I really think a project like this would be great for helping the homeless people to have shelter while maintaining their independence and their pride. But it could also be used as disaster relief shelters. You know, there, we could easily have a major disaster in a city where we have thousands and thousands of people that suddenly are homeless and we need to provide quick shelter. These would also work for that. It would be big enough space for two people to sleep and, you know, to take care of their basic needs. And that's what this structure is about. So I hope you like this design. It's called the Multi-Shack. You can get the plans for free on my website, simplesolarhomesteading.com. Up at the top, look at Multi-Shack. Now, there is a button there if you would like to donate. Your donations are used by me to design structures like this and build small houses. I work with a lot of homeless people that don't want to be in the system, that want to build their own off-grid cabins and houses and places like that. I help them with designs and building those projects. So any donation, if you can donate, is very appreciated and will help with those projects. All right, folks, I hope you like this project called the Multi-Shack, and have a great day.
Hi, folks. In this video, I'd like to talk about how to have a home with no house payments and no monthly utility bills. You may think that's not possible, but I do it, and lots of other people do it as well. I'm going to show you how it can be done, how it can be done very inexpensively, and just kind of give you some ideas for things that you can do that society and the economic powers that be don't want you to know. So stay with me for a second and let me walk you through this. First, you need some land. This is my piece of land, which is under an acre, about 3/4 of an acre. And that's really all you need to take care of most of the needs you have and for running a small homestead. Now, I was lucky enough to get this piece of property from family. It was willed to me when my father passed away. But I have also purchased small pieces of property like this for under $400. I have an acre down in Arizona near Sholo, Arizona that I purchased for under $400. I have 5 acres near El Paso, Texas that I purchased for under $700. So it's very easy to find a piece of land if you do some looking around. eBay is a good source for finding land. Tax sales are a good source for finding land. Family members may want to sell off a piece of land. Go around looking in rural areas and maybe you'll find a farmer that wants to split off a small piece of land and would gladly sell you one. You don't have to spend a lot of money on land. Okay? This is land that doesn't have utilities run to it. It doesn't have a blacktop road that runs into it or driveway. It's rough land. That's what you start with usually if you want to buy a small piece of land that you're going to homestead on. After you have your piece of land, then you're going to have a house. You can have a big house like most people live in, and you can pay a lot of money for it and have a mortgage and be a slave to the system for another 30 years, or you can decide if you'd like to build a smaller house like mine. Paid for with cash. This is my solar cabin. The cabin cost me $2,000 to build. That does not include the doors and windows, which I salvaged off of a trailer that was being torn down. for the cabin, it cost me $2,000. It is 14 by 14. Downstairs is living area, dining area, bathroom, kitchen. Upstairs, I have a loft, bedroom, and an office. In my other videos, I take you on a complete walkthrough of this cabin, so watch those if you want to see how the cabin is as large as it is and functional on the inside. Up there on my roof, you see my solar panels. That's a 350-watt solar system that provides all of my electricity needs for lights, TVs, water pumps, all miscellaneous gadget, laptop, TV, run my vacuum, and everything else off of a 350-watt system. That 350-watt system cost me under $3,000. $2,000 for the cabin, $3,000 for the power system of solar electricity, and I use propane. I have a propane tank in the back of the cabin, and I have a propane furnace, fridge, stove, and on-demand water heater, and those cost me just about $200 for an entire year. And we have cold winters here, folks. Under $200 for an entire year for all of my propane. That is the only utility bill I have. I do not pay for electricity. I do not pay for water because I drilled my own water well. Before I drilled my own water well, though, I hauled water in. But drilling a water well on a piece of property is not that hard. You can either do it yourself or hire somebody to do it. So I have no monthly utility bills. I have a house that's completely paid for. And I have freedom. A freedom that you can't get when you're under the pressure of a mortgage and utility bills. I want you to take just a minute and think about what you could do with your life if you had no house payments and no utility bills. And I'm telling you, it is completely possible. I'm not going to go into any details of how to get out of the house that you're in. You're going to have to figure that out and talk to some professionals for some help that way. All I'm here to do is tell you it's completely possible. Now, some of you are looking at the cabin and saying, yeah, but I couldn't possibly live in anything that small. This cabin was designed specifically for additions to be built on any of three sides. As you can see, the cabin has no windows on any of the three sides. There is a window in the back door glass. The sides are 14 by 14. The cabin was built to have shed additions built on all three sides. This cabin is 400 square feet approximately inside with 200 square foot footprint. When you add on additions, you could add on an additional 400 square feet on either side and off the back, giving you anywhere from 800 to 1,200 square feet. The great thing about building a small cabin to start out with, though, is it gives you a place to live when you build on your additions. And that way you can wait and live very cheaply without any house payments or utility bills. And then when you have the money, you can build on the additions to expand the cabin. That's very good for a single person or a young couple who don't have children because you don't need a whole lot of space to start off with. This way you can save for it, build on as you want to, have the additions, have the extra room if that's what you want. Now, I live full-time in this cabin. I live by myself, but my girlfriend comes up here on the weekends, and we stay together, and let me tell you, it's perfectly comfortable. We don't feel cramped at all, and we'd much rather have a small place like this. It takes a lot less money to heat. It takes a lot less money to cool. It's a lot easier to clean. It's just a fantastic home. Now, I'm not trying to push you into building a home exactly like mine. I'm just trying to provide you with some ideas. If you wanted to come up with different ideas, a different plan, that's just fine by me. But if you are interested in learning how to build a home like mine, I do have an ebook available and a printed book available called Simple Solar Homesteading. Go to www.simplesolarhomesteading.com. You can learn how to build a cabin like mine or at least get some great ideas for building your own home. Now, I want to repeat. I own my land. I have a house that I built for under $2,000. I have a solar electric system that I have for under $3,000. I use propane, which costs me under $200 a year. I have no house payments. I have no utility bills. If you want a life like this, it is very possible. You can stop listening to the media, and you can stop being put under society's pressures to live in the type of houses that everyone tells you you have to live in. You can live very inexpensively. And you can do this at any age, whether you're older or younger. If you're younger and you start in a place like this, imagine the amount of money that you would have to retire on with no house payments, no utility bills, and freedom.
And now, an exclusive first look at the upcoming documentary, 7 a.m.
Because true economic science is a branch of military science. War and money go hand in hand. Most wars are fights so people can make more money, and war is money. That means what? That the European American is not about to prepare black children to compete with his children for control of the economic sector. It's not going to happen. So if black people want this science, we got to teach it, we got to study it, and we're going to have to make some mistakes in perfecting it because we're still babies in the water of global economic commerce. As African people, we are financially illiterate. So we should not be surprised that we're so economically backward because we were never taught how to be economically forward. Our education in America has not provided or prepared us to be able to compete with Europeans economically. The historically black college was designed to do what? Teach you how to work for white people. Public schools, charter schools, parochial schools, independent schools. What is the purpose of education in America for black children right now? To teach them how to make a living working for white people. But I don't want the kids coming to my school to be going to class thinking that I'm learning this so I can go and get paid by a white person. They want to be empowered to start their own business. When they leave that school, they're going to go into business. And why do we need our people to be self-sufficient? Because when you're not self-sufficient, you can't speak your mind. One of the biggest reasons why black people have been so cowardly in the post-civil rights movement, not standing up for ourselves, standing up for our children, standing up against police brutality, we're scared to lose our jobs. We have to work. We got kids. I can't talk about the racism on my job. I might lose it. So the reason why we're not speaking our mind is because we don't have economic freedom. As Mr. Garvey said, Marcus Garvey said, that a solid racial program must be built on a solid economic foundation. Show me your economic condition, and I'll show me your political condition. The political economy of the black community rests on the premise that because they do not make their own money, they are enslaved to Europeans. And as a result of that, they will never be able to do what needs to be done to carve out a future for their children, because the hand that pays is also the hand that rules them.
Okay, time for another installment of It's My House and or DIY Housing TV. And today's podcast is titled 12 Days, or rather 12 Days of Building. So, here's what we got going. Based on the audio that we played on here, the first 20 hours, every month, from here on out, we shall have 12 days of building. All right. We use a certain amount of those days for manufacturing. In other words, learning the parts of the building, making the parts of the building, now making doors, making trusses, making roofs, making walls, that type of thing. And then, of course, then assembling what you have manufactured or made. And then, of course, then the e-commerce or the the monetized part of it. So 12 days a month. So typically, we might start on a Monday or two. Like, the days will be like Monday, Tuesday, Thursday, and then all weekend. If you can't make it on Saturday, we got Sunday. Can't make it on Sunday, we got Saturday. So we got, let's run through them. I may as well start through Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, Thursday, and then Saturday. Let's go through those again. Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, Thursday, and then Saturday. So that's that's 20 days. Excuse me, I should say, let me update this right now. Okay, you got 20 days to get 20 hours in. And let me update this right now. You know what? I put a picture up there, it said 12 days. So 20 days, 30 days out of a month now. Okay, let me... Okay, I'm updating this right now on 20 hours. And, okay, let me see what I got here. Oh, wait a minute. Okay, now, okay, wait a minute. One more correction or update, I should say. All right. Today's podcast has been retitled. Anyway, 20 days. So each day, in a month, you will have 20 opportunities to build. Now, hold on, let's get the days straight. Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, Thursday, Saturday. That's 5 days. All right? So 5 days a week, the 5 days that we picked out, times 4 weeks in a month, 5 times 4 is 20. All right, so here are the days that you can get boots on the ground, hands-on building instruction from us. Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, Thursday, and then Saturday. Those are... There'll be some, depending on the week, we might do like, because we start off with the foundation. And you're going to be spending at least 1 to 2 hours. So as in the book and the audio book, the first 20 hours, which we'll see if we can bring that up, you'll learn within a month, within 20 hours within that month. You got 20 days to get your 20 hours in. Now, some of you, depending on how you work it, you can get your 20 hours in within a week. All right? Once again, if you read the book, the first 20 hours, or listen to the audio book, you can learn the fundamentals or practically anything. We're talking about the fundamentals. Learning a language, playing a sport, baking a cake, pie, fixing cars, what have you. You can pick up the fundamentals in 20 hours. Will you be good at it? Most likely, no. Will you be a master at it? No way. But in picking up the fundamentals and practicing them in the first 20 hours, you'll know enough where you can self-correct. You can self-correct. Now, will it help if you get a tutor or somebody or a mentor or a teacher to help you get better along the way? Yes. But with the basic 20 hours, you can self-correct. All right, so once again, starting this month, Sundays, Mondays, Tuesdays, Thursdays, and Saturdays, those are our hands-on build days. There's some other things that will be included in that, but so that's, you got bare minimum 5 hours a week, 5 to 10 hours of a week where you can learn how to become debt-free. Five to 10 hours a week. Let's put it at five. All right. 5 times 4 within a month, you'll have what it takes where you can start eliminating large student loans, car payments, car debts, auto loans, mortgage payments, get vacation money, whatever you want. You can learn the fundamentals of it the way we do it, because we do it with building tiny houses. You can get all that in within today's Monday, by Friday, by Saturday. Fundamentally, you'll see how we do it. So it's up to you, you know, on what you want to do. But that's what we have available from here on out. And let's get to learn any skill in 20 hours.
Hi, everybody. I'm Jonathan Fields, and this is Good Life Project. So my guest today is Josh Kaufman, and this is a special episode. One of the things that we've discovered through a lot of our viewers is that the process of trying to live a good life, a better life, often requires you learning a new set of skills. We've had a ton of questions over the last year from people who say, I would love to do this, but I don't have time in my life to do it. I don't want to wait forever to make it happen. So we're bringing you Josh, who's also the author of a book called The First 20 Hours, who's an expert in, I guess, what I would call accelerated learning. So great to be hanging out with you today.
Thanks for having me. Great to hang out.
Couldn't sort of like have asked for a better person to drop in at a better time, because it really is. It's an interesting thing. It seems like the world is moving faster.
Mm-hmm.
We all want to get stuff done. A lot of people want to make big changes and feel like they're living better lives, but they look out there and they're like, there's stuff that I need to know, stuff I need to learn, stuff I need to master to do it. And I just don't have time in the day to
do
it.
Right.
So I'm curious. I mean, I want to get like right in with you, sort of like the idea behind your book.
Sure.
But one quick question first, which is, what was the motivation for you to actually go down this rabbit hole?
Yeah. So two primary motivations. The first is, you know, in terms of the research and the writing that I do, I like to look at topics that are like fundamental human experiences, like things that everybody needs to know or everybody deals with in some way, shape, or form. And those things can be, you know, big and complex and scary and frustrating in a lot of ways. But if you just dive in and break it down, what you often find is it's not really as hard as it feels.
Mm-hmm.
And so part of the motivation was, you know, learning is something, you know, learning new skills is a fundamental part of what it is to be human. Mm-hmm. And so let's figure out how to do that. Let's figure out how to do it better.
For me, the thought of learning new stuff, I'm giddy. I love it. But for a lot of people,
it's terrifying.
Right.
Particularly if it's something you know would be super fun or super valuable, but you know nothing about it, and you just look at it like, oh my gosh, this is really big. The motivation for me personally was I run my own business. My wife, Kelsey, runs her own business. And 2.5 years ago, our daughter, Leela, came into the world. And all of a sudden, we had zero free time. And I really geek out about this stuff. I have a list of things that I want to learn a mile long. And so, you know, not having any time, it's like, okay, I may only be able to set aside, you know, half an hour, 45 minutes a day.
Yes.
So if that's all I have, then, you know, let's figure out how to learn as quickly as possible in that short time.
And at the same time, you don't want to wait forever to get results. I mean,
that's
a lot of people are like, okay, I could figure out, like, I could scrap somehow to find, like, that half an hour a day. But does doing it so little mean that it's going to take me, like, 10 years to actually be decent enough at it so it'll actually be fun?
Right. And what I found through my research is that totally not the case. It doesn't take very long.
Yeah.
Even if you know absolutely nothing, or you only have a certain amount of time every day to sit down and learn it, you can become very, very good at something in a very short period of time.
Mm.
I think that's fun.
So, but this flies in the face to a certain extent also in what has commonly become known as the 10,000 hour rule.
Sure. A little bit. It's actually a lot more complementary than it would seem at the surface. So the whole idea of the 10,000 hour rule came from research by Kay Anders Erickson, Florida State University. And the idea behind that was, you know, if you look at the people in ultra-competitive, easily ranked fields, professional golfers, musicians, all of these folks where you can get an estimate of who really is the best in the world on an objective level,
right.
the question that Dr. Erickson was researching is, what does it take to get to that level,
right,
on
like
some
top,
very
top,
narrow
top
thing? Yeah. So yeah, if you want to step on a golf course and compete with Tiger Woods, that's about the amount of time it's going to take you to get there. But the vast majority of us, that's not the goal. That's not what we're trying to do. Mm-hmm. We just may have something in our minds that we want to accomplish, or an area of life we want to explore.
Yeah.
And it takes a lot less time to get what we want out
of
something.
And I guess for a lot of people, the motivation is probably one of two things. You want to get good enough so you enjoy doing it.
Yeah.
Or maybe like professionally, you want to develop a skill set enough so that you can actually start to leverage it to
absolutely
build your career or change your career for a lot of people.
Yeah. There are a bunch of things that you can learn that can help you do better in your business. There are a bunch of things that you can do to do for fun. It doesn't take that long.
Yeah. So let's dive right into it, because you kind of have a methodology.
Yes.
That you developed. So take us through it's five sort of like core ideas.
Yeah. Okay. Right. So the first step in this process, and this is something that applies to every skill. Could be a motor skill, like learning how to fly an airplane or skateboard or something like that. Could be a cognitive skill, like language or programming or something. So the first step is deciding exactly what it is you want, right? Why are you jazzed about this thing in the first place? If you're able to really clearly define what it is you're trying to get, it's called setting a target performance level. The more clearly that level of performance, or the more clearly you can define that, the easier it is for you to look out into the world and find ways to get there in the most direct way possible. Right?
So like, what's an example of that?
So for example, for me, I learned a lot of things in the process of putting together this book. And one of the things that I wanted to be able to do was program. And so instead of just saying, I want to be a programmer, right? Doesn't give you any information whatsoever.
So amorphous.
It's here is this idea of a program that I would like to sit down and create from nothing. And it looks like A, B, C, D, E, F, G. When I make this thing, I'll have developed the skills that are necessary in order to get the particular result, right?
Got it.
So instead of learning everything in the world about programming, I decided this is the subsegment of that skill I'm interested in learning first, so that's what I'm going to focus on first.
So it has to be like very goal-oriented and also very specific.
Yes. So what is it going to look like when you're done? What are you going to be able to see or experience that'll let you know you reached the level?
If you want to learn a language, I want to speak French enough, or is it
not enough?
So like,
yeah.
What would that look like in your sort of like framework?
So let's say, for example, I want to go to a restaurant that has a French-speaking waiter, and I want to order and conduct the entire meal in this language, and have a good time doing it. That's something that's specific enough to practice.
Got it. Okay.
So you make it too specific at the beginning, because once you get to that level, you can always ratchet up the stakes, right? You reach that threshold, practice something else.
I mean, what I found is once you get the most baseline proficiency in something, it sucks less.
Yes.
And now you actually, that baseline level, it creates a whole new level of motivation to want to learn more, because now you've kind of gotten through like the scales in music or something like that.
Yeah, and it's important to understand that the first couple hours of practicing something new are frustrating.
Yeah.
For everyone. Everybody's terrible at the beginning. And so, if you can push through those early few hours, the practice itself becomes fun and it becomes way easier to continue to improve.
So that's number one.
Yes.
Number two.
Okay, so after you decide what you want, you do what's called deconstructing the skill. And the idea behind that is a lot of the things that we think of as skills, like, for example, playing golf or speaking French or learning how to program, those aren't exactly skills.
Mm.
They're really kind of general topics that contain lots of smaller sub-skills.
Right.
So it's really hard to practice being a good golfer. It's way easier to practice hitting off of the tee with a driver.
Right.
You take the global skill and you break it up into much smaller parts. And if you're clear about what you want, it becomes very easy to find what are those sub-skills, what are the smaller parts that are actually going to help you get to that target performance level as quickly as possible.
So like if there are 100 sub-skills, if you've done number one, it makes it much easier to figure out, what are the 15 of those sub-skills that are going to give me 80% of the results towards getting where I want to go.
And what you often find is it's only maybe two or three sub-skills that you use most of the time.
Huh.
Yeah. So it's just, you know, breaking it down into small enough chunks. If you do just a little bit of research, which is actually step three, right? You go out into the world and you find sources of information that help you do this deconstruction. If you look at, you know, say for example, pick up five books on whatever it is that you're trying to learn how to do. Mm. And don't read them cover to cover. Skim all of them, one right after the other.
Right.
And what you'll see is the two or three sub-skills that you're going to use most of the time are the ones that come up over and over again. Right? So you just practice those first. And if you spend your time practicing those things and avoid a lot of the distractions or things that aren't going to help you, you save a lot of time and energy as you're practicing.
So that's a big question, so I'll ask you now. If out of a whole basket of potential sub-skills that add up to this thing that you want to accomplish, only a small handful are very often really, really critical, why are we taught to do them all at once?
Yeah, I don't have a good answer for that, actually. I think the biggest thing is we treat, in our culture now, learning as a very academic exercise. Mm. Like the objective is to suck in a ton of information about this thing, whether or not you're going to use it. And I think, you know, education in our culture now has been seen in the academic sense and less in the sense of practicing something with the eye of using it to do some particular cool thing.
So it's less applied.
Yeah.
More.
Yeah. So, you know, the whole idea of researching the topic, and something that I had to train myself out of, is I love doing research, right? So the first thing, like programming was a good example of this for me. It's like, I want to learn how to program. I get 10 books, I have these courses, I'm going to go through all of this stuff, and then I'm going to sit down and write a program.
Hmm.
It's like, no. You use the research, do just enough research to help you do the deconstruction and find the most important sub-skills first, and then get out of research mode and into practice mode as quickly as you can.
Because that's where the real stuff's going to happen.
Yeah. And when you start practicing what it is you're actually trying to do, that's when you see the performance improvement.
Now, you also made a differentiation when we started the conversation between cognitive skills, like learning a language, and did you use motor skills?
Yep.
Motor skills, you know, like swinging a bat or, you know, playing golf. Do all of these steps, I mean, we still have two more to work through, but you know, with the three that we covered so far, are they all sort of equally relevant to both types of learning?
Yeah, so for both types of learning, you have to go through the same general process. Some of the actual practice techniques can be different. So for example, one of the things that you can do when you're practicing a motor skill, which works really well, is practice it within a couple hours of going to sleep. Either taking a nap or going to bed for the night. There's a lot of research around the idea of what's called consolidation. So your brain translates the practice and experience you had and encodes neural connections to help you do it better.
Right.
That practice or that process is way more efficient if you practice within about 4 hours of going to sleep.
Hmm.
So I, in the process of writing the first 20 hours, I retaught myself how to touch type on a different keyboard, which is like, you know, having the experience of rewiring my brain to do something differently.
Right.
And then, you know, fun things like playing the ukulele, which is all motor skills. And it was surreal experience. I would practice it right before I would go to bed. And, you know, the first couple hours of practice was just terrible.
Right.
So I would practice, I'd go to bed, I'd pick it up first thing in the morning just to see. And it was like astounding how much better I was after a couple hours sleep.
That's amazing.
Because, you know, sleep helps consolidate that kind of
stuff. Yeah, no, that's really cool.
So yeah, some of the actual practice techniques are different, but the same, the general process is the same.
Right. So that's pretty remarkable. You literally wake up in the morning and you're better than you were when you went to sleep just because you slept in the middle of it.
Absolutely. So, yeah, so for...
Like noticeably better? Like really?
Noticeably better. Like, you know, in the process of learning typing, like, you know, once I switched keyboard format, I went from typing about as fast as I could think to literally like 5 words per minute. Like, terrible.
Right.
And so, you know, practicing right before bed and getting up in the morning and trying to use my computer, like, in the first couple of days I was doing it, it was like, oh my gosh, I can actually, like, type now. I can do something.
That's crazy.
And, yeah. So, you know, that type of thing works for a motor skill. For cognitive skills, memorization techniques like spaced repetition reinforcement, like flashcard model or flashcards with feedback helping you remember things works really well. So the actual practice techniques can be very different, but the core method of learning is very much the same.
And again, for both of them, before you go to bed,
yes,
helps with the consolidation.
Absolutely.
Very interesting. What about simulated practice?
Simulated practice can be effective as long as it is as close to real world performance as you can make it.
Right.
A lot of the trying to memorize something and then having that translate directly into practice doesn't really work.
Yeah, I guess I'm thinking more in terms of like motor skills.
Okay.
Yeah, when I was a gymnast, when I was a kid, we would before any event, I would basically, before I would step up to a piece of apparatus, I would kind of close my eyes and I would actually envision my body, like moving through the entire thing.
Okay.
And then there was all this research that said that, it triggers all the same motor neurons that would be triggered, like the same response in your brain.
Yes.
As if you were actually doing it, but I'm curious in terms of sort of like accelerated learning, whether that would actually make you progress faster and towards a high level of proficiency in that skill.
Yeah, there is quite a bit of research that says that imaginary types of practice does work, and it works well, with a catch, which is you have to do it in addition to
the real
physical practice.
Right.
Right. So if you're starting to consolidate those motor movements and you're doing that in practice, and then you're reinforcing that with imagined practice. Awesome.
Got it.
But what I found is a lot of people get caught up in the process of just doing the physical practice first.
So we got to three of the five steps now. Mm-hmm. So let's kind of like close the loop here. So step number four.
Okay. Step number four is removing barriers to practice. So things that are preventing you from actually sitting down and doing the work.
Okay.
Sometimes those things are environmental distractions, like turning off the TV or blocking the internet or closing the door, all the things that you can do to make sure in those early hours of practice, which are frustrating, you don't get so frustrated that it's easy to stop focusing on whatever it is that you're doing and start paying attention to something else. Likewise, anything that you can do to make sure it takes as little energy as possible to start practicing is super helpful at that point. So instead of keeping your guitar in the case in the back of the closet on the other side of your house, right?
Right.
Take the guitar out of the case, get a stand, put it right next to your next to your couch. And that just, anything that you can do to make it easier on yourself to get those early hours of practice, the better.
Yeah, I mean, my guitar is actually hanging out on a rack because of that. It's like almost because I just forget it's even there.
Totally.
It's like the visual cue actually makes a really big difference for me. Yeah. All right, so number four is, I'm curious also, it sounds like there's a bit of crossover between that and sort of like B.J. Fogg's work on really
tiny habits.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. It's, a lot of the same, this is where the behavioral psychology elements of this come in.
Right.
It's how can you make it easier to do the thing that you want to be doing instead of getting distracted by some shiny object and going and doing something else. So instead of relying on exerting a lot of willpower to force yourself to do this thing that you've decided you want to do, you spend a little bit of willpower, a little bit of time and energy, altering the structure of the environment around you.
Right.
And just make it easy as possible to do the thing that you want
to do. Yeah, totally makes sense.
Yeah.
All right, last item, number
last
five.
Last one. Pre-commit to practicing at least 20 hours. And this is the big one. So all the things that we've talked about so far is getting set up to sit down and do the work of actually practicing. The pre-commitment and the idea of practicing at least 20 hours, there's a lot of behavioral psychology behind that. The two big things is, first, it's a really important check on your reasons for learning this thing in the first place.
So it's kind of like, if I'm not willing to commit to 20 hours, I can't be all that serious about it.
Yeah, it's like, is it worthwhile for me to rearrange my schedule and stop doing other things? And, is this something that I'm expecting to get enough benefit from to make the effort worth it?
Yeah.
If it's not, don't do it.
Right.
Life is short, It's like, go do something else that you will get more benefit out of or you are more excited about. So if you're willing to set aside at least 20 hours, what the pre-commitment does is make sure that you practice long enough to push through that early frustration and actually start seeing results. And I think a lot of us really seriously overestimate just how long it takes to become good at something. Mm. So you can become really, really good at something, surprisingly good at something, in as little as 20 hours. So if you practice that long, you're going to be way better at the end of that than you were at the beginning.
Yeah. I guess a lot of people also figure, well, you know, 20 hours, you know, I've done that with a million different things, and you know, I really wasn't very good. But probably when they actually look back and say, well, no, like I missed 3 days here, and like that one day where I, you know, said I was practicing for an hour, I was really only practicing for 10 minutes. So when you really add up all the time, I'm guessing there's a little bit of self-delusion that happens.
There's actually quite a bit of research behind this. Our minds are not built to accurately estimate time. And in the early parts of learning something new, it's like, you know, it's terrible. It's like, oh man, I've been at this hours. And you look at the clock and you've been at it 10 minutes.
Right.
And so a lot of the, you know, both pre-committing to a certain amount of practicing. So 20 hours roughly is about 40 minutes a day for a month,
okay,
give or take.
So you kind of think in your mind 40 minutes a day for
a
month.
So a couple of, and I usually break my practice sessions into about 20 minutes apiece, right? So 2 20-minute practice sessions every day for about a month
cool.
can get you there. And so, you know, if you're able and willing to do that, pre-committing the time, make sure that you practice long enough to see that really good result. But it's also, you know, psychologically not, it doesn't feel like that big of a hurdle to say, okay, this is important to me.
Right.
I can set aside at least that amount of time, right? So it's just enough that you're going to see dramatic results, but not so much that it prevents you from making the pre-commitment in
right.
the first place.
I love that. So let's recap the 5 steps.
Okay. So the 5 steps in order. Step 1, decide what you want. What's your target performance level?
Mm.
Step 2 is deconstruct the scale. Separate it into smaller subscales. Practice the most important ones first. Number 3 is research the skill just enough to do the deconstruction and choose the most important subskills, but not so much that it becomes a barrier to practice
mm-hmm.
in itself. Number 4 is eliminate barriers to practice. Make it easy to do what you want to do. And number 5 is pre-commit to practicing whatever it is that you want to be able to do for at least 20 hours.
Mm. Love it. All right. So my mind is spinning because I'm thinking to myself, okay, what am I going to do?
I was going to ask. What's in the back of your mind? Have you always wanted to learn how to do?
It's interesting. I mean, languages, because I don't speak any other language.
Mm-hmm.
I took Latin for 6 years, which means I speak nothing but English. I just, you know, it's interesting. Like, I want to blow out a whole bunch of different things, but number 5 is making me say, I need to really think about this.
Yeah.
Because I don't want to, like, say, okay, people, I'm going to commit to this publicly.
Yeah.
And then, like, you know, an hour after we film this, I'm like, I'm not really, like, willing to put in my 20 hours for
mm-hmm.
that. So it's interesting. I'm really thinking that through. Awesome conversation. And I love sort of, like, the breakdown that you have. And this is all part of, this is all, I mean, obviously...
Yeah.
Detailed and, you know, a whole bunch more extensively in the first 20 hours. But thanks for stopping by and sharing this with me, because like I said, one of the consistent questions that we keep getting from people is, you know, I know that for me to get to a place where I feel like, you know, like I'm living well in the world, I'm doing these things, career, personal, whatever it is, there's a body of knowledge that I need to know and get decent at. But I don't know how to do it, and I think it's going to take forever. So I think this is a really great formula to help people get there.
Thanks. And, you know, I think the really good news is that the outcome of this research is the barrier to sitting down and learning something new is not intellectual.
Mm.
We're all smart enough to sit down and figure it out and practice in a
right.
smart way. The barrier is emotional. And so, you know, a lot of these things are just working with ourselves in a smart way to decide we're interested in doing something, figure out how to do it, and actually sit down and
right.
practice so we can do a bunch of cool stuff.
Love it.
That's fun.
Awesome.
All right.
Fantastic.
Thanks for having me.
My pleasure. My guest today has been Josh Kaufman, the author.
Malcolm Gladwell is here. He is a staff writer for The New Yorker magazine. His first 2 books, The Tipping Point and Blink, each sold well over 2 million copies in the United States. His unique take on the world ultimately has even spawned its own term, Gladwellian. His new book is called Outliers, The Story of Success. I am very pleased to have him back at this table. Welcome back.
Thank you.
Now tell me, I said to you as you sat down,
mm-hmm.
I am fascinated by performance
mm-hmm.
And success in terms of the essence of it, and how do you get there? Not that there's a magic formula, you know,
yeah.
but what can we understand about it?
Yeah. No, it is, it's this sort of perennially interesting question, and there are so many different answers depending on who you ask and when you ask them. And that's why we keep returning to it. If it was some little simple algorithm we could apply, it wouldn't capture our imagination in the same way.
It is said that part of the reason for this book, and there is some personal biography here,
mm-hmm.
you talk about your grandmother,
mm-hmm.
Was that you were in search of explaining your own success, this phenomenal success you've had.
Yeah, well, I don't know if it's a conscious attempt. I would never do something so explicitly autobiographically, consciously. But I suppose on some level, I mean, that question began to occur to me because my own success doesn't seem to me to be entirely rational, or it certainly wasn't anything I would have expected.
And you couldn't necessarily look at particular biographical points and say, aha, this guy is going to be either president or write bestsellers.
Yeah, it seemed that I got really lucky. I mean, luck is a huge theme in this book. And it's funny, and you know, we're not very good with luck. We either, you know, we tend to sort of discount it. We'd always rather give a kind of considered explanation for something than just to say it's happenstance. But you know what? A lot of the time, it really is. And I try and, you know, in the book, I try and sort of zero in on what is exactly the nature of the lucky break that characterizes so much of truly outstanding success.
Okay, let's take an easy example that you use.
Mm-hmm.
Bill Gates.
Yeah, so Bill Gates is lucky in many ways.
Yeah, very bright.
He starts two ways in particular. One is that when he walks into eighth grade at Lakeside Academy in Seattle in 1968, there is a computer terminal sitting there with a link into a mainframe in downtown Seattle. No one had access to a computer terminal in eighth grade or ninth grade or 10th grade or even college in 1968.
Anywhere else in the world.
No, and he himself told me, he's like, if there were 50 people in my position in 1968, I'd be stunned. And he basically spends his entire teenage years programming,
right?
Because of this gift. And he would tell me one point, Paul Allen, his great high school buddy,
right,
with whom he co-founds Microsoft, discovers there's a mainframe down at University of Washington that's free. It's not being used between 2 and 6 in the morning. So he goes to bed at 10 o'clock, sets the alarm clock, climbs out the window, whatever, at 1:30 in the morning, walks 2 miles to the University of Washington, and programs from 2 till 6. Now, I love that story because it's the two parts of his success are right there. One is the extraordinary desire and obsessiveness and determination and love of computing. But the other is the fact that he's a guy who lives 2 miles from a mainframe in 1973 that's free between 2 and 6 in the morning, mm-hmm. right? Now, lots of people may have the first thing. Almost no one has the second thing, right? I could have walked for a month and not come onto a mainframe.
Right, but this is central to what you're saying here. And so mm-hmm. let's explore it in more. The Beatles.
Yeah. Same thing. So Beatles, I mean, I'm really interested in one of the other themes I come back to in the book is this notion of how long does it take to be good at
exactly.
something?
Exactly.
And psychologists who have looked at this in the expertise literature have said, you know what, if you look at a whole range of cognitively complex activities, time and time again we see that expertise is reached only after a minimum of 10,000 hours of practice. And that roughly translates to 10 years of doing something. And I do this actually now with anyone who's good at something. I could do it with you right now. I just ask people, all right, in your career, what was the point that you started to feel comfortable in your role? And it's always 10 years. It's always 10 years. And I'm sure if we did the math with you right now, it would come out to...
No, you're right, you're right, you're right.
And so this magic number of 10,000 hours, what that says is the first in a cohort to reach 10,000 hours has a huge advantage.
Mm.
So Gates having that computer down the street, or that computer in eighth grade, gives him his 10,000 hours before anyone else who was that age. The Beatles, before they come to America, get invited to go to Hamburg. They're still teenagers, and they become a house band in a strip club, and they play 8-hour sets 7 days a week for months at a time. They get their 10,000 hours in before the British invasion, right? That's why they're good. I mean, it's not the only reason, but absent that kind of intensive grad school in rock and roll, they're not the band that we think they are, and they don't make that splash when they come to America.
And I assume that you could look at people who have been great athletes where there's a demand for poems at a young age, yeah. and discover that they started practicing under very good circumstances very early. Tiger Woods would be Exhibit 1.
Would be Exhibit 1. And the key, what you just said is key, what you said under very good circumstances. This is not just Michael Jordan going out and shooting baskets. The term that expertise researchers use is deliberate practice. That is to say, focused, intensive practice with an eye to zeroing in on your failures and addressing them, your weaknesses. Yeah. And I'm sure, you know, I would love to have a camera on Michael Jordan as a 16-year-old as he plays basketball and seeing, because I am convinced that that's what sets him apart, that when he practiced in a different way and that he was constantly thinking about what am I not doing well and why am I not doing it well and what can I do to perfect it.
Because, you know, he didn't make his team as a 14-year-old or something.
Oh, yeah.
The junior
yeah.
high team didn't make it and then became a star and got a scholarship to University of North Carolina.
Well, it's interesting, just to talk about Michael Jordan for a second. You know, unlike a lot of other basketball players, his game changes dramatically over the course of his professional career. And he's not a great outside shooter when he starts and has a, you know, devastating jump shot by the time he retires. So he never stopped this kind of constant process.
You know, he added to his arsenal and once he became a pro even. You know, I mean, there have been lots of examples of that. People that had a certain kind of college career and then they found out once they got to be a pro that they needed to add to it. But what do we read into this? We read in this access to deliberate practice over 10,000 times.
Yes.
May give you the opportunity for success.
Yes.
The opportunity.
Yeah. Yes. And that's a big thing because, you know, ultimately this book ends up with a series of kind of policy prescriptions because it's supposed to be a way of thinking about this question of how do we help people achieve their potential, right? And there's all kinds of ways to do that. And the very simple answer from the book is you give them opportunities to work harder. And so I end the book, for example, with a chapter about the KIPP academies in this new breed of charter schools.
Right.
Which is really based on this idea. There's nothing fancy about what they do. What they do is extend the school day, extend the school year into the summer, have school start at 7 and go until 6 at night, and have them come in on Saturday. And for kids who want to work harder, they will give you that opportunity. And the insight is that kids who want to work hard can't work hard unless it's a school there to do it.
That's true, too. But, I mean, what separates the kids who want to work hard from those that don't?
I have one of the chapters in the book is about Jewish lawyers.
Yes, right? Exactly. It's wonderful.
And it's all about this group of men who rise from the Bronx in Brooklyn, children of immigrants from Europe, grew up, parents in the garment industry, grew up in the tenements.
Right, in the 1930s.
In the 30s and 40s, and end up at the top of the legal profession in New York. This is hunger, right?
Right.
So, and one of the central ideas in that chapter is this notion that it was because they were discriminated against as Jews coming out of law school and, as a result, forbidden to work at the big downtown law firms, that they went out on their own and took up this unfashionable area of corporate law called takeovers and practiced it in isolation and obscurity for 20 years. And then
all of a sudden it became a big deal.
Big deal, and they were at the top of the game.
And they were prepared.
Preparation
meets opportunity.
That slight, though, at the beginning. The big fancy waspy law firm telling these kids named, you know, Greenberg or Flom or what have you, that you can't work here.
And we don't care what your grades were at Harvard.
And we don't care what you, or in their case, NYU.
Yeah, right.
But we don't care. That, you know, that slight is of incalculable importance. I mean, you just said that Jordan doesn't make his team when he's
14,
right? Again, that slight is that, I think that is the kind of added psychological.
But do you have that gene in you?
Did I have it? I don't think I've ever had a slight, but I'm not.
Not a slight. I mean, I don't think it has to be born of a slight.
No.
I think it can come from, and that's the intriguing question.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I just saw Rolling Stone. I mean, Rolling Stone has got a list of the 25 greatest singers.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
And including John Lennon.
Yeah.
Now, talent had something to do with this.
Yes. Yeah.
So where do we put that?
You know, obviously, it's there. What's fascinating to me is in the psychological literature on expertise, there are a whole group of psychologists for whom I have an infinite amount of respect who will stand up and with a straight face say that talent doesn't exist. that it's all application and effort. Now, I don't know if I'm willing to go that far, but what that tells me is, look, we think it's this much, and it's not. It's this much. You know, it's some tiny fraction of what we think it is.
I believe that because I'm being fascinated by the subject of talent and performance and what makes people the way they are. I have, in the history of doing this, more than 30 years, this show, 18 years, I have never had somebody say to me, you know, the reason I'm so good at what I do is because I'm smarter than everybody else.
Yeah.
It is all because I wanted it more, I worked harder, I focused more, I sacrificed more, and, more importantly, I had a deep passion for the thing.
Yeah.
Whether it was swinging a golf ball, hitting a basketball, doing scientific research, being a diplomat.
Yeah.
And they never lose it. Yeah. And it is their best friend, their very best friend. Everything else takes, you know, and then you get into work balance and all that stuff. Am I right?
Yeah. No, you know, when I think about the tour of the Beatles, what's fascinating about them, of course, is that they went to Hamburg in the 50s and were a house band for a strip club. Do we have any idea how miserable that must have been? 8 hours set. You must really, truly love rock and roll if you're willing to play as a house band in a Hamburgian strip club. I mean, the nastiest situation.
Yeah. You're willing to take the sacrifices necessary to get there.
Yeah.
So what do we know about Barack Obama? I mean, here's a man who's had phenomenal success. He's at the epitome of power in the world.
Yeah. Well, there's two parts of Barack Obama that fascinate me. You know, the second half of my book is all about culture, but the role that culture plays in success, and how different cultures have very, very different strengths in different. And so I spent a lot of time contrasting Asian and Western cultures, for example, and talking about how Asian kids are better at mathematics for cultural reasons, that there's something about their culture that's beautifully suited to
the
test.
This is intriguing. So tell us what it has to do with.
Well, I think it has to do. So we make this observation that there's a huge difference in the performance of Asian kids and Western kids on math tests, right? And we know it's not. We've refuted the genetic argument. They're not genetically better at it. And we also know that from a series of psychological tests that they work harder, and that's the key. They're just simply willing to persevere more. The application of effort is greater. So why? And I have this whole chapter, which is I think it has to do with patterns of agricultural practice going back hundreds, if not thousands.
Having to do with rice.
Rice. My father's European peasant ancestors who were, you know, in the wheat fields of northern England probably worked 1,000 hours a year and had lots of holidays and were drunk most of the winter and sleeping and worked till noon every day, right? Their Chinese counterparts in that same period were working 3,000 hours a year, weren't drinking out off the afternoons, and weren't sleeping through the winter. They were putting in a second crop of rice. Rice cultures are renowned for the fact that rice is infinitely more labor-intensive than traditional Western agriculture. And I think that if a culture engages in that kind of intensive work for 1,500 years, it doesn't go away. And so you take that child who is the product of that kind of culture.
It makes you good at math.
You sit that child down in front of a calculus problem, and they're going to approach it differently. And, you know, some people laugh when I give this theory, but here's the thing. No one has a better theory, right? We don't have any other explanation.
I know.
Asian and Western performance is not this much. It's this much. It's enormous, right?
I mean, that's always a good question and a good argument. Okay, maybe I'm wrong. What's the better idea?
Yeah.
And nobody says.
Yeah, someone's got to give you a better idea.
Okay.
Hey, everyone. Mike Stokes, Lush Planet Design Build. And today, what we're going to do is we're going to assemble Best Barn's 12 by 16, their Denver model. So here's what the brochure looks like. And we're just going to follow their instructions and put it all together and show you what I think, how it works, and how it doesn't work. First thing I want to tell you about this thing that we bought this is out of Home Depot. It's the standard model you can get online, and we got it without any roofing material and without a floor. So we're building our own floor. So if you come over here, basically what it calls for in the plans are 4x4 pressure treated skids. We're using 4x6s mainly because they didn't have any 16-foot 4x4s. And I also think, you know, it's just going to add that much more structural integrity to the barn. We're just going to go ahead and build the frame and level it out, and then I haven't even decided whether we're going to go right on the ground or whether we're going to put little pier blocks underneath it. It's a little easier to just build the floor and then set it up. I'm not too worried about level. We'll level it off after we build the floor. And then let me just show you how it comes. It was delivered in these two crates right here. So I just got them under tarps because it's raining. So you get one crate like this. Comes packaged up like that. Missing a spider right there. And then another big crate like this. That's it, the Denver model. So without further ado, we'll keep building. We'll just stop and show you little pieces as we go. So here we go. So just want to show you phase one. Basically, we're going for the quick and dirty install. So we just set the 4x6s on the ground, laid out, cut it to, it's exactly 12 by 16. So we cut all these guys to 3 inches minus 12 foot wide, and then laid it out and put our 16 on center studs in, floor joists, and then nailed it down to the 4x6s, and we just got sort of temporary shims up. Now we're going to level it out. So there you go, quick and dirty, floor of a shed.
Relax.
So I'm going to show you this little technique that we're using to level and lift the beams to the floor joists. So here we got our not level, but plumb. So we're a little bit out of plumb. So we put the clamp on it, push it down. So come over to this angle so you can see the plumb level. So get right in on the plumb level there, the plumb. Okay, so we push it down, levels it out, and then I usually have Corey here holding it, and then I'm just going to nail this down. You lift her up a little bit, yeah. And there you go. And then we did that all the way around to level out these runners.
Okay, that's it.
Okay, so at this stage, what we've done is we used the laser level. So right there, you can see the laser level. And we leveled up, we nailed everything together, and then we leveled it up with 2x6 blocks and other little blocks, and then backfilled it with the gravel so that everything was secured underneath the level. So if you can just see right here, that's 2 inches off of the board, and this right here is 2 inches off of the board. So a super easy and fast way to put in a shed foundation. You just build the frame and then jack it up. We just use pry bars and little pieces of wood and then backfill it with gravel. It's not going to be perfect, but you know, you can always do it again. You can stick a floor jack under there or a pry bar and jack it up, put a little more gravel in, stick another 2x6 pressure treated wherever you need. And then there you go. So quick and dirty foundation for a shed. And then now we're just going to nail off the sheathing. We're using these right here, ring shanks. So ring shanks have these little ridges on them. So they're not quite as good as screws, but they'll work really good to hold this flooring in for a quick and dirty shed setup. I think that's it until our next stage.